the topic for this evening has really two main pillars, like the Temple of Solomon being held up by two pillars, which somewhat uninformed gentleman once pronounced as Boaz and Jackass, I believe. however, please, the brethren who are traveling should not take that in the wrong spirit, because it's merely a mispronunciation. In any way, the two items really are Gnosticism and Kabbalah. I am sure that there are hardly any here who require these two terms to be defined. But let's just say very, very briefly that under Gnosticism, we understand the an early variant of the Christian religion, for the most part, because the so-called pagan Gnosticism is generally called Hermeticism, an early variant of the Christian religion of highly esoteric and, we might say, transcendentally psychological overtones, which has come into some prominence in recent decades in terms of the interest of the reading and studying public, because of the discovery in the, actually in 1940s, December of 1945, of the greatest find of scriptures that pertain to the Gnostic religious school, the so-called Nag Hammadi Library. And since then, there has been a considerable amount of exegetical literature, both of the academic and of the popular variety. On the other hand, Kabbalah is an esoteric variant of Judaism, or certainly an esoteric tradition which appears to have been preserved by the Jewish religion, and of which the first published documents appear in the latter part of the first millennium of the Christian era, although its origins probably go back much earlier than that. There has been throughout the two millennia of the common or Christian era, perhaps a great deal more attention devoted to the Kabbalah, as it is pronounced in Hebrew, or Kabbalah anglicized, than to Gnosticism, because it was the Kabbalistic teachings were never declared heretical and were not repressed either by Jewish or by other religious authorities. In fact, the Kabbalah has found its entry into Christianity and Islam in addition to Judaism as well. Both of these subjects are reasonably well known by now in at least the more learned circles of our culture. What is perhaps less well known, however, is that the two have really quite a number of features in common. And it's to that commonality that my reflections will be devoted to this evening. The late Professor Gershon Scholem, with whose writing some of you may be familiar, and who was certainly in his time, and I think he died maybe about 20 years ago, 15 years ago or so, the greatest known authority on Jewish mysticism, has briefly defined the Kabbalah, in fact, as Jewish Gnosticism, which remark I'm sure caused some raised eyebrows at that particular time. He's the gentleman who has pretty much become his successor, as who was one of his students, and who is probably the leading authority on Jewish mysticism today. Professor Moshe Idel has continued in that vein, and also regards Kabbalah as being Jewish Gnosticism. Now, A little more needs to be said, however, at this point about Kabbalah or Kabbalah, because while there are systematizations, systematic descriptions of the mystical visions of the great Gnostic teachers that can be diagrammatically organized and depicted if one so chooses, the Christian Gnostic tradition does not really have a visual central design which represents its heart and essence in many ways, but the Kabbalah does. And as no doubt many of you are aware, that design is known as the Tree of Life, Etz Chaim in Hebrew, it is available to you on that little diagram that we have on the handout. It consists of 10 spheres, vessels, sephirot, as they are called in Hebrew, with interconnecting channels. And it can perhaps be most accurately described as a design that shows the creative linkage between completely transcendental spirit at the upper end and material embodiment at the lower end, and everything that's in between. Now, this everything that's in between, however, is mostly, that is, 9 out of the 10 vessels, which appear like circles on your design, are in the immaterial or usually invisible realm. Only the lowest one, Malkus, the kingdom, has, let's say, a physical aspect and is physically discernible. From which circumstance we can immediately derive the conclusion that according to the Kabbalists, at least 9/10 of reality is non-physical and only 1/10 is physical. In any event, this is the central core of Kabbalah. Without the Tree of Life, none of the Kabbalistic teachings would really make any sense at all. There are about 4 principles, which I will very briefly enumerate because they are relevant in a fundamental manner to the relationship of Gnosis and Kabbalah, or Gnosticism and Kabbalah. There are about 4 laws or lawful processes that are revealed in that Tree of Life. The first of these is certainly a teaching that Kabbalah and Gnosticism have in common, and which is, of course, also one of the principal underlying cosmological features of the teachings of Theosophy and of Madame Blavatsky's teachings. In her very first big book, in Isis Unveiled, she already has a big and very complex and very unique design of the Tree of Life. In any event, this is what might be called the law of emanation. The Tree of Life and we ourselves within it, with all other creatures, therefore, according to this feature of Kabbalistic teachings, are no mere fabrications or creations of God or of a God, but we are rather the outpoured essence of the ultimate wholeness. We are not fashioned by an ultimate intelligence, but we are extensions of the ultimate intelligence itself. Although it must be admitted that as these extensions occur, sometimes the intelligence of the ultimate intelligence decreases within the extension, as I'm sure you have noticed when confronted with some of your fellow humans. Never, of course, with yourself, but only with others. The ultimate intelligence is probably more clearly represented in cats, because, as you know, they have many, many great intelligent features. So this is an essential concept, which, when we extend our gaze over the different variations and modifications of esoteric teaching throughout history, whatever they may be called, and of course in every age they receive some new appellation and a new formulation, but it's present in all of them, namely that the universe and ourselves and all other beings visible and invisible within it have emanated from an ultimate source of reality. But of course, as the Gnostics have recognized and perhaps expressed more powerfully than anyone else, as this outpouring or emanation takes place, the farther away the emanated essence proceeds from the source, the more likely it is that complications and phenomena of alienation are likely to take place, such as I just mentioned in jest, but also somewhat with some degree of seriousness, the decrease of intelligence. Also the decrease of the immediate power of the ultimate spirit. So that what is at the end of the emanated line, as it were, often turns out to be, at least in external appearance and in some of its functioning, rather different from the source from whence it came. Yet with all of that, it always retains a certain essential core quality, which is identical with the source from whence it came. Madame Blavatsky's famous secret doctrine, which of course is an esoteric document of, again, of very unique qualities and import, uses a magnificent metaphor of sparks that fly out of a great conflagration, a great fire. And in that sense, we ourselves and the universe are in the nature of the sparks. The flame is the original reality, what the Kabbalists would call the Ein Sof Ur. And as one very wonderful exegete of the secret doctrine years ago, the late Professor Ernest Wood, whom it was my privilege to know, was wont to say, speaking of ourselves as the sparks, you have to remember that there is the sparkness of the spark, but there is also the flameness of the spark, meaning that we are at once alienated from the ultimate reality, the divine. We have become forgetful of it. We no longer know where we came from and who we are. But somewhere inside that essence of that ultimate flame, that ultimate fire from whence we as spark came, is still inside of us. And if we manage to scrape away the ashes, or whatever, to continue with the metaphor, and maybe apply some of the breath of the spirit, you know, breath, atem, atma, spiritus, to the little ember, then the spark is there. And that is, according to Kabbalah, according to the Gnostics, really our ultimate hope. And this is a view of reality and a view of human nature that is really very different from that which we find in mainstream religiosity, particularly in the mainstream religiosity of the great monotheistic faiths of Middle Eastern origin. We call them religions of the West, Judaism and Christianity, but they're really Middle Eastern with Western modifications. The second of these laws is the law of balance and equilibrium. And I'll pass over that quickly because this is not as relevant to our concerns this evening, but it indicates that the tree of life, which is the functioning system of the emanations, of the emanational reality, functions on the basis of a certain dynamic equilibrium. And that when that dynamic equilibrium is there, then the system functions well. When that is disturbed, when imbalances arise, then things don't work well. So as one Kabbalist has expressed it, the evil, the bad, das Böse, as it would be called in German, which actually also means the angry thing, in the Kabbalistic view is something that is out of balance. And more about that later. And then the third is the principle or the law of unity in diversity, which means that both diversity and singularity in the sense of unity are fundamental principles within the tree of life. The tree of life is one, it's one organism, yet within it there are 10 vessels, each one having very, very different qualities, and 22 interconnecting paths which also have their own qualities. So multiplicity or diversity and unity are equally present. An issue which, on a much different level, I think on the level of society, we are struggling with now in the world. Is diversity more important than unity in a nation, in a culture, in the world? Well, probably not, even though that might be deduced from certain politically correct ideas, because these are great principles of reality which exist simultaneously and which complement and supplement each other in order to make a viable living organism, as it were. And the fourth and last one is a sort of a logical conclusion derived from the above three, and that this one is very, very relevant to the Gnostic Kabbalistic connection, because this is what we might call the principle or the law of the ability of the emanated portions, including ourselves, the sparks, as it were, to return to the source. That even though the furthermost and the most distant emanated portions of the tree of life may have come out and may have wandered very far from the source, they still retain within themselves the ability to return to the source. They are not lost. Now then, with that we can proceed further now to the convergence, let us say, of the Christian Gnostic system and the Kabbalistic system. And for that matter, even though I won't talk about it this evening, you can also throw in the Hermetic Gnosis as a third. Where did this strange thing, the tree of life and the various ideas about it and around it, really come from? How did people come up with this? It's not the kind of a design or so that you would very easily come by way of external sources. You can walk around in the biggest forests for a long, long time and you're never going to find a tree that looks like that. If you do, if I did, I would run so fast out of that forest that the hounds couldn't catch me. Even with my bad knee, I would get out of there very fast, because something would be very, very weird. So where did they come by this? Well, here again, Professor Gershon Scholem had, I think, a very, very fine theory. I'm sure it was not unique to him, but he, I think, made it acceptable to more people than anyone else did before. And here, possibly the fact that Gershon Scholem was a good friend of Carl Jung and of Joseph Campbell and of various people of that sort had something to do with the situation. In fact, the only time that I met Gershon Scholem was at a Jungian conference in 75, which was not convened on the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Theosophical Society, but it was convened on the anniversary of the birth of Carl Jung, because the two are in the same, are the same, the same year. And Gershon Scholem, partly influenced perhaps by the kind of thinking that, that Jung and other, some of those creative people represented, said that this originated in experience. That probably for quite some time in the history of Judaism and of the Jewish people, there were some people, and we know about that, the so-called travelers in the chariot, the Merkava, and that what these people were practicing mystics whose spirit would assume an externalized form from their bodies, and who would find themselves in consciousness traveling in the invisible, ordinarily invisible realms, ultimately reaching the throne of God. This, incidentally, in many ways is a concept rather similar to the one that was very prominently represented in the early history, let's say, of the Theosophical Society and of other esoteric movements in the 18th and the 19th century, and came to be called astral travel. That one can travel by other than physical means, and primarily in the spiritual worlds. The consciousness can leave the body and acquire, I don't like to use that word, it's so computerized, but information. The metaphor for this travel was traveling in a chariot, because there are sort of spiritual chariots that appear in the Old Testament in connection with people like Elijah and Ezekiel and so forth. And so these were the people who traveled in the invisible realms. These invisible realms, both in Jewish thinking and in Islamic thinking, largely Arab, always included a very large number of experiential realms which exist, let's say, between our embodied existence and the ultimate reality itself. There are all of these intermediate realms. And so that these people did this for a considerable period of time, and according to Scholem's reasoning, eventually they sort of got together and started comparing notes. And the result of the comparing of the notes was the drawing of a sort of map upon which they agreed. And this map is the Tree of Life, the map of the journey of the soul, which, like so many other journeys, of course, is twofold. Just like I came here from Los Angeles yesterday, and I'm going to, hopefully, if I live that long, I'm going to go back also. So there, there is a forthcoming and a homecoming. So that this is the pattern according to which life, the energy, emanated, came down into material manifestation, and it is also the map of the path, the Tree of Life, whereby the return shall be accomplished. And that is, of course, a very important Gnostic point. Now then, the truly Gnostic aspects, the most explicitly Gnostic aspects of the Tree of Life and of the entire Kabbalistic system were not really communicated, however, until some centuries after the initial publication of the Zohar and the Sefer Yetzirah, the two original Kabbalistic books, when a remarkable Jewish mystic by the name of Rabbi Isaac Luria Ashkenazi came upon the scene, from Spain, even though he was called Ashkenazi, so his family must have come from Western Europe originally, who lived between 1534 and 1572. And he really became the most Gnostic of all Kabbalistic teachers, who presented an entire mythos of impressive proportions and Gnostic content in order to explain to Kabbalistic students the real nature and the purpose of the Tree of Life. I could draw a sort of a parallel, between the Gnostic teacher Valentinus on the one hand and Luria on the other. Even as the Christian Gnosticism reaches its highest and most sophisticated and most mystical expression in Valentinus and his school, so the Kabbalah, I think, reaches its highest degree of mystical sophistication in the teachings of Luria. Incidentally, if you want to read Luria, like so many other great teachers, he didn't write anything himself, but his writings were collected by some of his disciples, and they exist in fairly accurate translations called the Ten Luminous Emanations, but the difficulties of reading through all of that by far exceed the difficulties attendant upon reading Blavatsky's Secret Doctrine. And that's saying something. So you probably do much better with sort of recensions and references to Luria in other works as long as they are fairly accurate. Luria also had, at least in my estimation, this is my extrapolation from his writings, about four great important teachings which are added to the teachings found in the Zohar, found in the Sefer Yetzirah, and which represent really the Gnostic essence of Luria's Kabbalism. And these are as follows. The first, which is sort of preliminary but extremely important. Luria said that no one can be a good Kabbalist unless he has been visited by Elijah. Now, on the face of it, that cuts a lot of us out. Now, of course, you can follow the Jewish custom at the Passover meal and so forth of leaving the door open if you don't live in a very crime-ridden area and leave a chair open for Elijah to come in because Elijah, of course, is the archetypal fellow who has never died. There is a likelihood that that also applies to Moses, but it applies more to Elijah, and who therefore, since he hasn't died, can appear anywhere. There is a deep mystical meaning to this. For Luria meant thereby that there has to be an inner experience of gnosis, something in consciousness. One has to meet the archetypal teacher before one can meaningfully address these esoteric matters. Because if one does not meet Elijah, then the Kabbalistic system, like so many other systems, will become a fascinating intellectual preoccupation, but will not reveal its full import to you. And that, of course, I think happens very often. The mind, the intellect, is a very active portion, and it gets fascinated by certain things, and one can derive a great deal of satisfaction from an esoteric turn of one's intellect. But then when one merely engages in that, then something really happens. So, in a certain way, Luria said really what Gershon Scholem came to say later on. There has to be experience. Studying esoteric matters is not enough. Although certainly studying is useful, but it's not enough. And so one has to meet Elijah. Another one of his teachings is what in Hebrew is called zimzum, meaning retraction. And thereby he meant that when the emanation comes forth, of which the tree of life is a manifestation. This occurs by reality emptying itself. So what once was a totally full, complete reality, something that the ancient Gnostics in Greek called pleroma, by way of the emanation becomes relatively empty. Physical manifestation within which we live is relatively empty of spirit. Otherwise, it couldn't exist. So there is that kind of contraction of reality. As reality, as spiritual reality contracts, physical reality expands. Similarly, physical reality has to contract in order for spiritual reality to make itself manifest. Now, this may sound like so much sort of old synagogue hair splitting to you, but if it is translated into immediate experiential terms, then it means very much like what St. John of the Cross, San Juan de la Cruz, meant by the darkness of the soul, the dark night of the soul, which is not a period of profound repression, as a lot of people who don't know St. John assume, but he said that our involvement in our fascination with outer things has to diminish. The outer world has to darken, and then the inner light will shine that much more brightly. And so similarly, if we want to return in consciousness to that ultimate light, then the emanated outer world now has to contract in our consciousness. It has to become less. As the outer becomes less, the inner or the greater becomes expanded, and we can perceive it better. And this is not a devaluation of the outer world. People are terribly afraid of this business. Oh, you are a bunch of world haters. You don't like the outer world. Well, no, but there is. It's a matter of a kind of economy of consciousness. You can't be intensely aware of every doggone thing simultaneously. Even if you don't begin to suffer from the loss of short-term memory and things like that that age imposes on some of us. You can't have it all in your mind. Even Sherlock Holmes, that archetypal figure, was wont to say that the mind is like a closet, and you shouldn't clutter it with things that you don't need. So this is the principle of the. Now the next two are very, very Gnostic, and therefore our purpose is very, very important. And one of these is very, very weird, but a reality other than the one we are used to is always weird, and so it's approached by strange metaphors, unusual stories, and so forth, and then we have to somehow apply our consciousness to it to try to discern its essence. Luria said, things are wrong. Where we are, where we are living, what is going on, is not entirely right. Things are sort of out of kilter. And we try, of course, to remedy these in one way or the other. We are forever tinkering with our reality, trying to make it right. But you know what? All these thousands of years and we still haven't succeeded. Fixing goes only so far. And so he said, here is the reason why things aren't right. Somewhere along the line, something has gone wrong. And what has gone wrong, he defined as the Sheviat HaKelim in Hebrew, which means the breaking of the vessels. And the great metaphorical story which he came up with is to the effect that before this tree of life, way, way back out of time and out of mind, there was another tree of life. And with that tree of life, something went wrong. The vessels broke. There was too much energy in it. And for those of you who are conversant with these terms, there was too much gevura in the first tree of life. This Gevura energy broke the vessels and the tree burst asunder. See, the Jewish people were always very practical people. And they said, you know, God can make mistakes too. It's a kind of a Christian inflation to say that our God never makes a mistake. Everything is always perfect. Nothing is perfect. Jewish people always knew that. And tried to work with it, which is not a bad idea. Because if you're going to work with this world, you're going to work with something that is not perfect. If you're going to live with yourself or in any other human being, in addition to that, you're going to be living with someone who is not perfect. Now, if you're living with cats, it's different. Once again, let's not forget the cat. But what occurred was that as the vessels broke, the light that is within within the first tree of life spilled. And a lot of it went back to the source, but some of it could not. And is held captive in the abyss, in a mysterious and horrible realm that is sort of behind the tree of life. And there the fragments of light, the sparks of light, are being held captive by demonic beings who are known as the Kliphot, or which are the shards, the pieces of the original vessels. And now a rescue operation needs to take place, because these sparks of light can't make it back on their own. And that rescue operation is the present tree of life and ourselves within it. So Luria said that a whole new emanation of worlds took place for the express purpose of rescuing the light that was lost. The entire tree of life is a messianic structure. And everything that lives within it has ultimately a messianic intent. Now this has some frightfully serious implications, namely that you and I are a bunch of messiahs. Even though the narcissistic part of myself rejoices in that, but it also scares me because it really represents such an overwhelmingly large task. And like most people, I'm naturally slothful and negligent, and I don't like big, important tasks. I know that I'm not adequate to them, and besides that, they are just simply too much work. And I'm sure that in some part of yourselves you feel the same way. The spiritual work ethic is too much. In any event, a messianic structure, a rescue operation, incidentally you find exact parallels to that in many Gnostic scriptures, probably the most powerful ones in the writings of the Persian Gnostic prophet Mani, after whom Manichaeism is named. In any event, the breaking of the vessels has eventuated in the emanation of a new world, which is largely a new tree of life series of worlds, because there are four olams or worlds in the tree of life, which is in the nature of a rescue operation. You combine that a bit with Christian Gnosticism. You combine that with the greatest Gnosis of Asia, which is Buddhism. And you see that the rescuing, the liberating, the saving of all of these lost spiritual entities is the great work of all the Buddhas and all the Bodhisattvas, including those who aspire to become Bodhisattvas. And this is, of course, where the element of compassion, of pity, enters the picture, because it's incumbent upon everyone within this tree of life to have that kind of messianic consciousness. Even though, of course, the great messianic forces are present within the tree of life, particularly in its center, in what is called the sphere or the vessel of Tiferet. And flowing from these considerations, last one, tikkun, which means the restoration. So this is, of course, the nature of that messianic work, that we are involved in this messianic process. Therefore, the great task is the restoring of a lost wholeness. In certain ways, one might say the return to a lost wholeness. That is really the great work in which we are all engaged, and which ultimately needs to take place. So Luria really tells us, as I think the Gnostic tradition has always told us, in all of its manifestations, Christian or otherwise, that we have to face our existential conditions. We are living in a realm from which the ultimate reality has at least relatively withdrawn. This is in many ways the wasteland, the empty place. And there are problems here, including real evil. Incidentally, the Kabbalah recognizes two kinds of evil. And that, again, when the implications of that are fully apprehended, I think is a very, very important recognition, in which most of us are lacking. One kind of evil, says the Kabbalah, is the relative evil that indwells the tree of life itself. And that merely means the unpleasant, the harsh side of the manifest order. When life and nature kicks us in some portion of our anatomy or the other, dependent on the situation, then we say, ooh, that's bad. This is no good. This hurts. We call it evil. We call it bad. And it occurs in all kinds of ways, psychologically, physically, in all sorts of ways. The mere fact that as I'm beginning to notice that the parts of the body begin to wear out at a certain point. Just like a car, there are some parts that the mechanics can replace. So knees, hips, this and that. And for others they can't, when the engine goes, it goes. And that's the heart and so on. And believe you me, all the eating right and all the exercising and all the jogging cannot really stop that process. Neither can it stop the fact that your memory goes out. Now, for instance, here is the story. It is really apocryphal. I was going to pass it off as an experience, but there is a limit to prevarication, even on the part of a lecturer. It's the story of a gentleman of some advanced years, and his wife, and he tells his friends that they have been to a wonderful restaurant, had an excellent, wonderful meal, and was very cheap too, and everything else. And so they ask him, well, tell us, where is it, so we can go there. And of course, what happens? He doesn't remember. But he says, yes, oh, tell me, what is the name of that flower that is long, it has thorns, and it smells good? I say, well, Rose? Yes, Rose, what's the name of that restaurant where we've been? So there are psychological problems, there are physical problems because of the imperfections within the system. And these one takes into account and tries to work with them within the tree of life, including restriction, let us say. But Luria says that because of the original breaking of the vessels, there is also another kind of evil. And that evil is not part of the system. This is literally out of this world. And that is the evil of the Cliffords that hold the sparks captive. Very, very nasty. In fact, several Kabbalists whom I respect said, of the Cliffort, don't talk about them too much. It's just not good to talk about them much. They have names. In the Lurianic Kabbalah, even names have been given to them and so forth. This is, again, to speak of the Gnostic image, this is what in the Gnostic scriptures appears as the midst, because it's sort of nowhere. It's neither here nor there. And in the Gospel of Thomas, in the Gospel of Philip, in Pistis Sophia, Jesus speaks of it as the terrible place where we shouldn't be found. Now, these statements are not made in order to scare us, but they are made, I think, to indicate that, in fact, these are the very words, I'm almost certain from the Gospel of Thomas, that there is evil in this world, but there is an evil that is beyond this world, which is called the midst. Very, very much like Luria. But it's rather the indication that it's not all sweetness and light. There are dark elements which keep our spirits captive, and it's incumbent upon us to recognize that and to deny them and to tear ourselves away from them. It's enough to know that, but that much is. So the notion that all darkness is light disguised, or all evil is good dressed up in a Halloween costume, is not something that Luria would agree with. Ontologically, which means according to being, you might say that everything that is, including Hitler and Stalin and Pol Pot, came originally from the ultimate source. That is true. But right now, as we are confronted with it, it is incumbent upon us to have discernment between the good and the bad, and even between the important and the unimportant and what is in between. It is part of our task to make that kind of discernment and to make these determinations and to act and move according to them. Not a notion that is probably terribly popular in New Age circles and so forth, but which is certainly part of these teachings. And then, very, very important, and I'll soon conclude, if we take Luria's gnosis to heart, and again see its exact convergence with other gnoses, then we find that it is also important for us to distinguish between what might be called the hidden and the ultimate God and the mere creator God. Now, I deliberately phrased it this way because I wanted to see the monotheistic hackles of some of you being raised. And this is a little hearkening back to my annoying qualities, which our president has referred to today. But what? Two gods? What are you talking about? If you look at Madame Blavatsky's writings, for instance, she was certainly a true Gnostic in this regard, because she continued to insist that the creative agency or agencies which the Western, so-called Western, Middle Eastern, monotheistic religions revere as God is not the ultimate reality. And that if one merely concentrates in terms of one's God concept and one's worship on this world-creating and world-managing will, to paraphrase good old Arthur Schopenhauer's concepts, then one is really cutting oneself off from a reality greater than that. And that we need to be able with our, or I suppose the Kabbalists would say our neshama, our spiritual soul, to be able to rise beyond the world-creating and the world-managing will to an ultimate reality, which is beyond that, and which in the Kabbalah, both Lurianic and otherwise, is represented by the Ein Sof Ur, the limitless light out of which the Tree of Life came. So this also is an important issue. The metaphor for it is the God of this world is not the ultimate God. I will beg your indulgence just for a minute, taking trying to draw some conclusions from that. When we look, for instance, at ourselves, we might say that we have reality creating and reality managing, godling within ourselves. Some people call it ego, can be called by other names too. And if we don't see beyond this, then we have no real contact with our true ultimate self. There is a self within us that doesn't manage things, that doesn't organize our reality, that doesn't have any concepts and precepts and plans and agendas, but just is. And unless in this lifetime we make some contact with that isness, not business, then we haven't really made it. We haven't really lived. The other is also important in its own right. It's a kind of tree of life that functions, but there is something else. So don't be satisfied with that which makes and manages and organizes, but proceed beyond that to something that is ultimate being, ultimate consciousness, ultimate reality. It's possible because it is embodied within you. And by way of that principle, that spark of the ultimate flame that is within us, we can also join in consciousness the ultimate flame, as perhaps we shall in the long run. And that, of course, leads us pretty much to what I think is some of the last conclusions, namely that the humans are very special beings. We have a very special nature, and thus we have special tasks and special responsibilities. The Gnostics, along with many other people in the ancient world, of course, always said that the human, these are broad divisions, and then Madame Blavatsky and others have divided them further, but the broad divisions of body, soul, and spirit. And that we need to work our way through soul or mind up ultimately to spirit. We have to make contact with that. In the Hebrew Bible, there is a sort of development. There is the nefesh, soul, used in the Old Testament, which is a sort of vital entity, like an etheric body. And then later on there appears the ruach, which is very much like intelligence, like the nous of the Greeks, and also psyche. And it is only in Kabbalistic times, really in later rabbinical times, that there appears the neshama, which is spirit. And this is the one which we need to recognize and which will lead us to the ultimate summit. We need to pay attention to this. The Zohar, for instance, says in Before Luria, the heavenly Adam who emanated from the primordial darkness, he is the one who created the earthly Adam. So that we are indeed made in the image and the likeness of that heavenly Adam, and within us dwells the energy of the ultimate another Zoharic statement that will bring me to the conclusion very soon. Man is both the important and the highest degree of creation, for which reason he was formed on the sixth day. As soon as man was created, everything was finished, including the upper and nether worlds, for everything is comprised in man. He unites in himself all forms. To these, of course, Luria adds, let's say, the practical implication that because of this, the human has the great obligation to discover his own spirit, his own neshama, and by way of the discovery of that spirit, to become a messianic agency for the liberation of other spirits and the other captured forms of light within the emanated, within the manifested worlds. And so I think in a brief outline form, I think I have indicated to you these various elements in Kabbalah, which are all of a thoroughly Gnostic character and which are in complete agreement with the insights of Christian Gnosticism and of Hermeticism. And I think that when we see this, then we may be able to have now a clearer comprehension of the great foundations, really, of the esoteric tradition, at least as its Mediterranean manifestations are concerned, and perhaps the rediscovery, increasingly, of these foundations may lead to a reawakening of some of these deeper insights in more and more people in our culture, and thereby perhaps the fulfillment of high hopes which such people as Valentinus and other Gnostic teachers and Luria and other Kabbalistic teachers have invested the human consciousness and the human race with. Certainly, we can nourish that merciful hope, and we can employ ourselves to the limits of our ability to justify and to fulfill that hope. And if a little stimulation in that direction, a little stimulus has been presented this evening, then our presence here this time, I think, perhaps has been to some degree rewarded, which is what I hope for. And I thank you very much at this point, and I'll conclude the formal portion of my remarks.